From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. A federal court ruled earlier this year that two of North Carolina's congressional districts drawn in 2011 were unconstitutional because they were racially gerrymandered. That case is to be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court next week. Earlier this week, in a separate ruling, a federal court ordered North Carolina to hold special elections next year for the state House and Senate after 28 state districts are redrawn to comply with a gerrymandering ruling. All of those maps were drawn by the current Republican majority after the 2010 census. But gerrymandering is not a political strategy reserved for one party, nor is it anything new. The tactic is older than its name, going back in the United States to the 18th century. According to a history published in The Atlantic, Patrick Henry persuaded the Virginia state legislature to remake a new district to thwart the political ambitions of his opponents. It was decades later, the early part of the 19th century, when the term gerrymander was coined. After Massachusetts Governor Elbridge Gerry signed a redistricting plan into law that a newspaper declared looked like the shape of a salamander. Using the governor's last name, the term gerrymander was coined and it stuck. Today, we're going to learn more about how gerrymandering really works and hear about a project that drew congressional district maps for North Carolina without considering politics. We'll also explore research out of Duke University's math department that sheds light on how gerrymandered North Carolina actually is. Joining us now is Tom Ross, the Terry Sanford Distinguished Fellow at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He's also former University of North Carolina System President, and he is the current president of the Volcker Alliance. He joins us from Duke University. Tom Ross, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and pleasure to be with you.
Also with us today, Jonathan Mattingly, professor of mathematics and statistical science at Duke University. He is also chair of the math department. Jonathan Mattingly, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Quite an honor to be here.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about redistricting, give us a call on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Tom Ross, this project that you spearheaded as a collaboration between Duke University and Common Cause that set out to draw congressional districts in North Carolina without regard for political affiliation, tell us how this came together and how you engaged this panel of 10 people.
Well, my work here at Duke has been focused on redistricting since I first joined, and I was approached by Common Cause with the idea of trying to think of a way that we could show people that redistricting can be done in a different way, in a nonpartisan way. And so we came up with the idea of doing a simulation of what an independent nonpartisan redistricting commission could do, how it would look and how it would function and what the outcome of such a panel might look like. So the idea was that we would try to get some people that were well-respected North Carolinians that would act as an independent commission that would not consider party registration or political voting history in drawing districts, so that we would end up with districts that didn't take into account party politics but would comply with the federal law and would comply with all the rest of court cases that deal with population variance and those kinds of things.
So
it's important to know that the criteria that we used was actually taken out of a bill that was introduced in the state house and passed the state house, but did not ever pass the Senate, and that was under in the Republican legislature. So you're right that this is not a partisan issue. This is an issue that where Democrats have taken advantage of gerrymandering, Republicans have taken advantage of gerrymandering, and I think what it's led to is increasing voter dissatisfaction. So what we hope to do is show there was another way. So the judges that we asked to serve on this panel, and we chose judges because among all public officials, they still have a relatively high credibility. And also, I used to be one, so I knew a lot of them. But we ended up with five former chief justices of the North Carolina Supreme Court. We also had a former associate justice of the Supreme Court. So six former members of the North Carolina Supreme Court, two former members of the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and two Superior Court judges. We were careful to select five that had run for office as Democrats and five that had run for office as Republicans so that it was a balanced panel. And then we provided them with a lot of background information about the demographics of North Carolina, not voting demographics, but you know, a lot of the demographic information about the state. We also provided them with some legal background in terms of what the requirements of the Voting Rights Act are, what the requirements of one man, one vote are. And then we asked the judges to draw districts. We broke them into two groups and asked each group of five judges to come up with a map. And the only instructions we gave them were that you had to comply with the criteria set out in House Bill 92. And we asked one group to start in the western part of the state and the other group to start in the two urban areas, Wake County and Mecklenburg County, that are too large to have their own district. The population of Wake and Mecklenburg County exceeds what the population of a congressional district is. So we told them to start in those two places and then go from there. So they each came up with maps. We then brought the judges back together and deliberated on the maps which was best, and ultimately the judges agreed upon one map, and we turned that over to Jonathan Mattingly and his crowd to do an analysis of it. But we also, you know, held a news conference in which we explained what our process was and compared the map the judges had drawn with a couple of previous legislative maps.
And we'll
drawn
get
by Democrats in 2001 and also by Republicans in 2011.
And we'll get to Jonathan Mattingly's assessment of those maps in just a moment. But Jonathan Mattingly, tell us a little bit about what you discovered when you, part of Duke University's math department, and your students took a look at the outcomes of the 2012 elections. What did you see?
So 2012 was that election was actually what got me thinking about this question. Just a few facts. In that election, the majority of North Carolinians voted for a Democratic representative in the election, barely, just over 50%, 50.6, I think, and the remainder voted Republican. But yet, when the votes were tallied, there were four Democrats elected out of the 13 representatives, so four Democrats and nine Republicans.
And with 50%, just to be clear, of the votes
Go ahead. Over 50% went Democrat, but only four of 13 representatives.
Right. Okay.
And that was, you know, that was surprising to me at one level. And another level, a part of me said, well, you know, I believe in regionalism. I believe that the urban areas have different concerns than maybe part, you know, the farmers or the coastline, the northern part of the coast or the eastern part of the coast, southern part of the coast or the area around Asheville or the far west of the state. I grew up in North Carolina and I understood that. And I was kind of interested in trying to understand to what degree it is. You know, it came from that regionalism. And the surprising thing is I think we talk a lot about one person, one vote and making sure that everyone gets to vote. But even after you've taken the votes, there's a lot of latitude in what the outcome is based on how you draw the districts. And it's shocking, actually, how much you can change the outcome of an election just by redrawing the districts. So, for instance, if you take the 2012 elections and you keep the votes exactly the same, you don't change a single vote, mm-hmm. you keep every precinct voting the way it voted initially, and you rearrange in a random way, but in a random way that tries to be faithful and stay true to this exact same House Bill 92 that Tom just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then you ask, well, what are the possible outcomes? It turns out that you can get anywhere from 4 to 9 Democrats elected, and with the vast majority being between 5 and 8, and the most likely are 6 or 7 Democrats elected, when in fact only 4 were elected. So just by never changing a vote, never doing anything other than rearranging the districts, you can change the outcome a lot. And so the question is, you know, is just making sure one person, one vote enough to preserve our democracy? And I guess my answer would be no.
And there are principles that are laid out in House Bill 92. This is something that I think was last taken up in February of this year. And we don't know if that's going to go anywhere, but can you briefly describe, Tom Ross, what those ideas are, what this panel of judges and what John Mattingly's project was trying to take into account as they drew these maps?
Well, House Bill 92 had a number of provisions, but the most important one in terms of our work at Duke was the criteria that it sets out for what could and should be considered under that bill if it became law in drawing districts. And there were certain key principles that the people who were drawing the maps could not consider partisan voting history or party registration. The districts needed to be compact. The districts needed to not be concerned with the residency of incumbents. And the districts needed to avoid breaking up counties or precincts to the extent possible. And I think I should say here that it's impossible under one man, one vote standards, one person, one vote standards in North Carolina to not break county lines, because you have two counties, as I mentioned earlier, Wake County and Mecklenburg County, that are both larger than the size of a congressional district if you divide the population by 13. So you have to break county lines, but this bill said do that only to the minimum extent you have to. So that's really what the criteria are. Frankly, I think legislators pay some attention to compactness and trying to avoid breaking too many county lines. They traditionally have, and both parties, again, have definitely paid attention to incumbents where they live and oftentimes draw districts specifically for incumbents.
And we're going to have to...
And they also have considered very carefully party registration and voting history.
And we're gonna have to pick this up. Hold on, Tom Ross. We're about to go to a break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about redistricting in North Carolina and how a nonpartisan approach could foster fairer representation and potentially more competitive districts. If you have a question for our guests, call us on this Wednesday, 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today about how North Carolina might approach redistricting in a fairer, less partisan way, particularly in light of recent rulings ordering state lawmakers to redraw racially gerrymandered districts. With us today to answer your questions, Duke University math and statistical science professor Jonathan Mattingly and Tom Ross, the Terry Sanford Distinguished Fellow at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy and former president of the UNC system. If you'd like to ask a question about redistricting or gerrymandering during this live Wednesday discussion, call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Tom Ross, just before we went to break, you were talking about the principles laid out in House Bill 92 that state legislators might use and that your panel used to create this map that did not take into account political affiliation or partisan politics. You said that state legislators do pay attention to compactness, but what are some of the principles laid out in House Bill 92 that they're not adhering to right now that would turn this into a fairer process?
I think there are two. One is obviously considering partisan registration and voting history. They consider that very carefully now. House Bill 92 would prevent them from considering it, and I think that would lead to more competitive districts and districts that voters feel have more confidence in. And then secondly, when they're drawing districts, they pay close attention to where incumbents live and where they think incumbents can sort of be protected, and that is something that would be also prohibited under House Bill 92.
Other than judicial orders, do the state legislators have any incentive to consider taking partisan politics out of this?
Well, I think it's interesting to think about that question, because if you look historically in North Carolina and really in many states, gerrymandering is a practice that happens with both parties. The Democrats were quite adept at gerrymandering when they were in control of our legislature. The Republicans have been quite good at it. And both parties get better and better because of the use of computers nowadays. But I think the one incentive that both parties have is uncertainty about the future. You know, what the political tone and outcomes of future elections will be, demographic changes, all those things matter in terms of who's going to win elections. And so uncertainty, probably more than anything else, is the incentive for change.
John Mattingly, Duke's math department took a look at the maps drawn by Tom Ross's panel of retired judges. What did you find from a statistical point of view? How fair are these districts that this panel of judges drew?
So maybe it's worthwhile for me just to say a second about what we did. So what we did was we, using just exactly the bipartisan, the nonpartisan criteria that Tom just laid out, mm-hmm. of compactness and separation of population and splitting of counties and the like, we generated thousands and thousands of redistrictings. And then we reran the 2012 elections, for example, with those different redistrictings, and we tabulated the results. And then we asked, well, how typical are the results that one gets from the judges' redistrictings, or from the redistrictings used in the 2012 or the 2016 elections? And we found that the judges were right in the middle. They were much better. They were clearly representative of what the vote had been, whereas the 2012 and the 2016 were way out on the edges. But I want to circle back and just say one thing, which is that, you know, I'm talking about the results, but I think it's also a lot about responsiveness and whether districts are responsive to the people in them. And we found also that the judges' districts had many more districts close to the center, which could possibly be flipped one way or the other relative to the other redistrictings.
So they actually drew more competitive districts.
Correct. And that was one thing we really tried to do. This wasn't just a question about who won, who lost. It was really, we also came up with a measure of competitiveness, that is to say, the level of gerrymandering. And the judges' districts were much less gerrymandered. That is to say, the most Democratic district had the same number of Democrats as it typically did when you drew them randomly, and the most Republican had the same number that typically happened when you drew them randomly, and had about the same number in the middle, you know, in the sweet spot that could be flipped one way or the other as randomly drawn districts.
You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring the gerrymandering of North Carolina's congressional districts and how state lawmakers might approach a nonpartisan redistricting process. Our guests today are Tom Ross. He is the Terry Sanford Distinguished Fellow at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Tom Ross is also former president of the University of North Carolina System and the current president of the Volcker Alliance. Jonathan Mattingly is a math and statistical science professor at Duke University. He's also chair of Duke's math department. They're both joining us from Duke University today, and we're inviting your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. In Wisconsin, a three-judge panel recently found their redrawn maps unconstitutional. They determined it was a partisan gerrymander. And if this ruling stands, could this set a legal precedent? This was published actually in the New York Times earlier this week, I believe, for a mathematical formula in this case identified what they're calling an efficiency gap. And the way they described this mathematical efficiency gap, they said the formula divides the difference between the two parties' wasted votes. Those are votes beyond those needed by a winning side, and votes cast by a losing side, by the total number of votes cast. And when both parties waste the same number of votes, the result is zero, which is supposedly ideal. But as a winning party wastes fewer and fewer votes than its opponent, its score rises. So in this Wisconsin case, Republicans won 48.6% of the two-party vote, but took 61% of the assembly's 99 seats. Have you looked, Professor John Mattingly, at an efficiency gap?
So I haven't looked at the specific work that you're talking about, although I was reading it this week with interest. But we had a similar idea. I mean, it all comes down to the same question. Are you putting many more of one party in the extreme precincts, the districts that are going to go Democrat? If they're going to go Democrat, if you put more Democrats than are necessary in there, typically, then you find that there are less in the middle, and it shifts things in the Republicans, and vice versa. For instance, if you take Maryland, we looked at Maryland, Maryland is not as gerrymandered by in any stretch as North Carolina, but yet when you look at the districts, they're definitely built to protect the Democratic majority and therefore to be less responsive to what the people want.
Tom Ross, would you say that gerrymandering affects not only the ability of minority groups to be represented, but also the willingness of politicians to reach across the aisle when they're in office? And can you talk about that dynamic?
Certainly. You know, I think it's one of the problems you have with districts that are not competitive. And let me just say that in the most recent election, congressional election, the winner that had the least percentage of vote had 56% of the vote. So if you're thinking about wasted votes, the person who had the closest election won 56-44. Most of the margins were in the 60-40 range. So we really have very few districts, if any, in North Carolina that are truly competitive. And so the result of that is that if you're a Republican in a Democrat district or a Democrat in a Republican district, you don't really feel like you have a voice. And, you know, there's really not a voice much after a primary. And what I think happens is that politicians don't really have to be as responsive to the voters during a reelection campaign because their seat is safe. And so the voters have a more difficult time holding candidates accountable. They don't feel like their voice is really heard, and they become disengaged. And at the same time, I think it's possible that in the both parties, that because you're safe in a general election, the risk you run is in a primary, so you tend to move to the extremes of your party. And I think that's true in either party. And so you end up with people who are more on the extremes and therefore less able to compromise and less able to govern. So I think it does have consequences for our democracy, and which is why I really believe that we need to move to a nonpartisan system.
Is there any correlation then, Tom Ross, between, say, the lack of willingness of politicians, and I'm thinking now of Capitol Hill, to compromise and negotiate versus the way people talked about what it might have been like 20 or 30 years ago? Is there more gerrymandering going on across the country now than there was a couple of decades ago?
I suspect there's more, but we're also better at it. You know, computers have really made this much more of a science and less of an art, and so I think that's part of what's going on. But the truth of the matter is that the legal contest to gerrymandering, you mentioned the Wisconsin case, and if I might take a moment on that because it's really important.
Sure.
Historically, the courts have stayed away from redistricting cases unless there's an allegation of racial gerrymandering. They've never considered really partisan gerrymandering because the courts have a doctrine traditionally that they don't examine political questions. But the Wisconsin case is really historic in many ways because it's to my knowledge, the first time that a court has held unconstitutional a legislative or a congressional map based on partisan gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering. And so you ask the question, if that were upheld, you know, what would the impact be? It could transform politics in America in a hurry because if it were upheld in the U.S. Supreme Court, then every state would have to have a nonpartisan methodology, or at least there would be a risk that if they used partisan politics too much, that they would cross a constitutional line. And so that case could really change things a great deal. And there's a similar case pending in North Carolina attacking the congressional districts for partisan gerrymandering.
And that is based on this efficiency gap. Wasn't the ruling based on the fact that they were able to say this is the mathematical formula that establishes this as gerrymandered? In other words,
right, I think
there's actually there's a way to identify a district technically as gerrymandered, correct?
I think that was very helpful to the judges because it's a, you know, when you start talking about gerrymandering based on partisan politics, one of the tough parts a judge has to face is, well, how do I know when partisan gerrymandering has gone too far so that it violates the Constitution? And I think this mathematical process that was used by and presented to the judges in the Wisconsin case was the first time we've had a really solid statistical methodology presented to judges that would allow them to be able to draw a line between what is too much partisan gerrymandering and what is permissible. And so I think that is a very important part of that case for sure. But Jonathan's work is not dissimilar in the sense that it allows you very easily to see that there are lots of other ways you could draw districts that are more competitive than and that are fairer in terms of the voter outcomes than the way we do it now. If you look at 2016, 53% of the voters voted for the Republican candidate in Congress, 47% for the Democrat. If you apply that to 13 seats, it's 7-6. The election was 10-3.
And I'll just add on, I mean, this idea of coming up with a way to quantify if something was, how gerrymandered something was really one of our big motivations. We were really interested in trying to understand, you know, how to identify the level of gerrymandering. And the ideas are very close to what was used in the Wisconsin case, in fact.
And so can you, Jonathan Mattingly, say, based on this particular set of criteria, that this is absolutely a gerrymander? I mean, is this shades of gray, or is this something that where there's a clear dividing line?
In between black and white, there are shades of gray, but mm-hmm. Sometimes something's black and something's white. And I would say in this case, it's black and white. But I don't think we'll ever have a fine tooth, you know, dot meter that tells us, oh, now it's in the red, it's over. But I think we can talk about, we want things that are, you know, somewhere in the reasonable zone. We want districts that, yes, they are influenced by politics, of course, and yes, they're influenced by local considerations, of course. But sometimes you cross a line and you reach to a level of gerrymandering that's unacceptable. And I think that that's what's been happening in various places in the country now.
You're listening to
According to our analysis. I mean, that's what our analysis shows.
Right. You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring the gerrymandering of North Carolina's congressional districts, how state lawmakers might institute a nonpartisan redistricting process. Our guests today are Jonathan Mattingly, math and statistical science professor at Duke University, and Tom Ross, the Terry Sanford Distinguished Fellow at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. They're both joining us from Duke University today, and we're inviting your questions on this Wednesday. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Bill from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
A quick comment, Rachel, even though Terry Gross does not have a call-in discussion, I put the two of you in the same category in terms of the knowledge reflected in your questions. I'm curious about how can you allow for incumbents in these races where it's like 60-40, something like that? And is there an opinion, even though it's outside the discipline, topic, is there opinion on what might be the advantage of having open primaries as they do in California, where the top two vote-getters go into the November election, regardless of party?
Good question, Bill. Have either of you, Tom Ross or Jonathan Mattingly, looked at open primaries like those in California? Thanks for your call,
think,
Bill.
You know, that is a great question, because that is a new approach that California is using. California also, by the way, has adopted a nonpartisan redistricting system. And I think people's initial reaction has been positive to open primaries of that type. I also want to address the question about incumbency. House Bill 92 would prohibit the drawers of maps from considering where incumbents live. You wouldn't have to do it that way. You could still draw districts without regard to partisan politics and without regard to voting history, but pay attention to that if you thought that was an important factor. But the House bill, it did exclude that as one of the factors.
And we have an emailed question from John. He asks, is it even possible to produce a single-member district system that is immune from gerrymandering if any criteria other than proportional representation by party voted for are included? To make the question interesting, allow cracking third parties out of any representation at all?
You know, you never want to say never, but I think we can do a lot better. I think that should be our goal. I think, you know, in voting systems, there is no Arrow's impossibility theorem says that there is no good voting system. You write down a reasonable set of criteria, and every voting system you write down will violate one of the criteria. So I don't think we can let the fact that there's no perfect one dissuade us from finding good ones.
If I might add, I think that it's important for all of us to remember that there's an increasing large number of voters that are registered as independents, that aren't registered as Democrats or Republicans. And yet we draw the maps in many places around the country using partisan gerrymandering, where we are favoring one party or the other and really ignoring independent voters completely.
And he also used the term cracking in his email. We've heard packing and cracking, and I'm not sure that we've actually explained how this works. Why does cramming voters of one ilk, for a racial group or a group of voters with one political affiliation, why does that dilute their votes, Jonathan Mattingly? Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you know, if you have a split that's very close, you know, in the general population, but then imagine that you take all of one party and pile them into two or three districts, so they win by 90% in each of those districts. Necessarily, you're going to have many less of those voters left over to put in the remaining districts, and you can then tilt them to the other party, even though, according to the proportionality, you know, it should have been the other way. I don't know if I should suggest this, but if you look on Wikipedia, there's a very nice graphic that shows up in various newspapers, the Washington Post and other places from time to time, that explains this. It's one with little red and blue boxes. You'll find it if you go looking for it.
And we will post that on our website also. It is a good visual. You're listening to Coastline, and Tom Ross, we'll get to you when we come back after this break, talking about the impact of gerrymandering in North Carolina and a potential new approach to drawing district maps that leaves partisan politics out of it. You have one more segment to ask your question of Tom Ross and Jonathan Mattingly on this live Wednesday show. Call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today about gerrymandering in North Carolina and how state lawmakers might approach the drawing of district maps to create districts that are fairer, more representative of their constituents. With us today to answer your questions about redistricting, Jonathan Mattingly, Duke University math and statistical science professor, and Tom Ross, the Terry Sanford Distinguished Fellow at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Tom Ross is also the former president of the University of North Carolina System and the current president of the Volcker Alliance, a nonprofit launched 3 years ago to improve public trust in government. If you'd like to ask a question of our guests, you can give us a call on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, Tom Ross, you were about to jump in after Jonathan Mattingly explained why packing voters into a certain district dilutes their vote.
Yeah, I just wanted to be sure people understood the cracking part of packing and cracking.
Yes.
Packing is when you take all the voters that are similar in their voting history, one party or the other, and put them in one district, as Jonathan explained, so that the impact of their votes are diluted by putting them all in one district. Cracking is sort of the opposite of that, and that is where you've got a concentration of people that historically have voted in the same way for one party or the other, and you're trying to draw districts that are favorable to the party other than the one where this concentration of people is. You crack them. That is, you break them in parts and put them in different districts so that their, again, impact on the outcome of the election might be diluted.
And we have Jesse from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering what you meant by a possible way of redistricting. Is this on the table, or is it just a way of doing it?
That's a good question, Jesse. We need to clarify this. I've been referring to the fact that there is a bill, House Bill 92, in the state legislature. And Tom Ross, you're actually very familiar with the process that this bill has gone through and where it is now. And your project, your collaboration between Duke University and Common Cause to draw these theoretical district maps with a nonpartisan or a bipartisan panel of retired judges, it was a completely separate kind of experimental educational project. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the issue is one that I've been interested in, and what we've seen happen around the country is states beginning to move to a nonpartisan method. California, Arizona, and others are moving in this direction. And what we were trying to demonstrate with our simulation, our project with Common Cause, was that North Carolina could have a commission that was a nonpartisan commission, a bipartisan commission that drew districts on a nonpartisan basis. Legislatively, what's happened is there have been bills historically, 89, 99, 2009, and then House Bill 92, that have been introduced in the legislature calling for nonpartisan redistricting. None of those bills have ever passed both houses. House Bill 92 did pass the state House of Representatives, but was not taken up by the Senate. And of course, we're starting a new legislative session this year, so House Bill 92 is technically dead, and there would have to be a new bill introduced if this were going to be considered by this General Assembly. You know, there are lots of ways this could be accomplished. It could be accomplished through legislation, or it could also be accomplished by a constitutional amendment where the Constitution were amended to require that redistricting be done in a nonpartisan way.
And again,
and there are a lot of people that think that's the best route because then neither party can go back and change it if they get control. They're going to be, or at least it would be much harder to change.
You said, Tom Ross, that there are a number of states that have already adopted nonpartisan processes. How many are there? Is North Carolina behind, or are we sort of with the pack in terms of how quickly states are moving on this or not? Where do we stand?
Well,
against the rest
behind,
of the country.
But I don't think at all. I think that this is a relatively new trend. There have been some states like Iowa that have been doing it in a nonpartisan way for a long time, 20-plus years. But the states that are tending to go this way are states that allow referendums by the people. And so when it's been put on the ballot as a referendum, the people vote for it because many, many polls, as well as these elections in referendum states, have demonstrated that the public is really tired of this bitter, divisive politics, and they see fixing redistricting as a way to help solve this problem. And so I think there is increasing attention to this. I think the court decision in Wisconsin also has brought attention to it. But, you know, North Carolina is not behind. There's still the majority of states that allow partisan gerrymandering, but it happens at various levels in states, obviously, depending on how the parties break down by in each state. So if it's a real strong red state, there's going to be probably a little less gerrymandering. If it's a really strong blue state, the same. It still does happen in those states, by the way, but not quite to the same extent it does in places like North Carolina that are much more even in terms of the parties.
We had a caller ask this question. He's gone, but Tom from Southport asks, I'm a registered independent who did not vote for Trump. The Democrats gerrymandered for years, but now when the Republicans managed to get in and gerrymander, now it's not okay anymore? Why the outcry now?
Well, that's a great question, except I think there has been an outcry in the past. As I said, there have been bills introduced by Republicans in the past. There have been bipartisan bills. House Bill 92 was a bipartisan bill. There are people in both parties that feel like this needs to be fixed. So there's been a lot of discussion about this for many, many years. It's an issue that I think a lot of people believe is critical if we're going to fix the sort of broken democracy that many people believe we have now. So there has been an outcry in the past, and he's exactly right. The Democrats did it before. The Republicans are doing it now. And neither, in my view, are right about it. What we need to do is focus on a new way. And I think there is increasing interest in it.
And I'll just add that, I mean, I think Tom said this earlier, that there's an arms race technologically. Now we're able to gerrymander much more effectively. And so we're able to, in some sense, do much more damage to the electoral process than we were before. And also simultaneously, we're allowed to use techniques like we're trying to develop to give a nonpartisan read on whether a redistricting is gerrymandered or not.
How does compliance with the Voting Rights Act play out when redrawing district lines? What are some of the issues that we have to look at? We talked earlier about packing and cracking and what that means, but are there not still, isn't it important to draw majority-minority districts? How does that work, Tom Ross?
It is still, the Voting Rights Act still is in play, and it does require that we continue to draw majority-minority districts. I think the question becomes, what is a majority-minority district? And, you know, it used to be that people thought, well, you had to have a very, very high percentage of minority voters in that district to make it winnable by the candidate of choice by the minority group. But I think people now realize, and again, computers have helped us figure this out, that the percentage of minorities that need to be in a particular district to ensure that their candidate, whether it's a member of that minority or not, their chosen candidate or the candidate they prefer, actually wins. And so we can now, I think, do a better job of complying with the Voting Rights Act and at the same time allow districts to be drawn that are more competitive across the entire state. So it still has a role to play as long as that law's in force. I think it is possible to draw very competitive districts and still comply with that law.
And I'll just add in that in our analysis, we completely took into account the Voting Rights Act. So when we were generating these thousands of random districts that we used to kind of suss out the true signal in the vote, we only generated districts that had a certain fraction, that always had at least a district that had 40% minority, and always had a district that had at least 35%. And we had a few, you know, benchmarks, target percentages that we put in. We took those target percentages, in fact, from the districts that the judges drew. So we chose the same percentages that their top three or four districts had.
And just to be clear, once again, that's Jonathan Mattingly, math and statistical science professor at Duke University, also chair of Duke's math department. Jonathan Mattingly, you are not suggesting that this project could develop, say, software that would draw these maps. You are just evaluating maps drawn by people based on certain principles. And why is that an important distinction or not?
Well, for me it is. I think you know, the system can always be gamed if you make it too rigid. And I think there's always criteria and some politics always that needs to go into the process. I think the question is, can we help answer the question, not just make it, as one of the callers said, you know, you did it last time, now it's my turn and I'll do it now. How do we decide what's too much? You know, I'd like to say, you know, gerrymandering, where do you draw the line? Quite literally, where do you draw the line if something is too gerrymandered?
You're listening to Coastline, talking about the gerrymandering of North Carolina's congressional districts, how state lawmakers might approach a nonpartisan redistricting process. We're talking with Tom Ross, Terry Sanford Distinguished Fellow at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy, and Jonathan Mattingly, Math and Statistical Science Professor at Duke. We're inviting your questions on this Wednesday, and we have Dennis from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Hi, Dennis. Are you still there?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. There was a little beep, and I didn't hear my name. I just wanted to point out that you could have a complete imbalance in the results of the congressional district elections, even though they're at the state level, there is almost no difference between the registration if the excess for one party is evenly distributed over all the congressional districts. It could be 51 to 49 at the state level, and yet there's a one- or two-vote majority in each of the districts and end up with 11 to 0 to take the numbers in North Carolina. So my point is that I think we have to be a little careful about what measure is used to decide that somehow the districting is inappropriate. whether it's gerrymandered or determined in some other way.
Thanks so much. Yeah, go ahead, Jonathan Mattingly. Yes.
Yeah, let me respond to that. So, I mean, I agree with you completely. And that's why in our generating these random districts, we did not look. These are not engineered districts. We did not look at the registration. We did not look at the voting history. We only allowed our random sample, our generation procedure to say, you know, how good was a district based on a score function that took into account how well did it separate the population? How compact was it? Did it split counties? Did it satisfy the Voting Rights Act? And if it did all those things to varying degrees, then we awarded it a score. And there's a simple way to randomly sample districts that have good scores. And that's what we did. We randomly sampled thousands and thousands of districts with good scores. You may quibble about one or another, but we found that even when we turned the dial, when we changed the parameters, when we changed how we did it a little bit, the results were always the same. 2012 was heavily gerrymandered. 2016 was a little bit better, but still not so great. And what the judges did was much, much better.
We have a question. Peg writes, what are the most common objections to nonpartisan district maps? Tom Ross, why does this keep failing when it comes up?
I'm not really in a position to say what people say about what the strengths of partisan redistricting are. You know, it's something people don't talk about a lot, unfortunately, and I think it's something we need to talk more about because I think there are a lot of negatives to partisan redistricting, and I think we've seen that with gerrymandering that has caused voters to become less engaged and that in many cases politicians aren't as accountable to the voters as, you know, we would like them to be in a strong democracy. So I think there are a lot of positives to trying the nonpartisan way. I mean, we've seen the results of partisan redistricting, and it tends to be, a divided democracy that is not as functional as I think we all wish it was. And so, I think there are a lot of positives about trying it a different way.
And we've been looking at North Carolina's congressional district maps, but what about the state districts? Is that something, Jonathan Mattingly, that your students might look at some point?
We'd like to. I mean, conceptually, theoretically, there's no difference in the kind of analysis we did could easily be applied to those to the state General Assembly districts. The problem is that at the moment we don't have that data loaded in. It's much finer grain. It's not at the level of precincts. It's at the level of census tracts and census blocks. And that's a much bigger problem. The scale of that is bigger. We're actually considering looking into it. But at the moment, we're not quite set up to do it. But maybe we will be in the near future.
And one of the
We got some motivation this week.
I think the principles are the same, and you certainly could look at it.
Yes, and it's interesting because just here in southeastern North Carolina, there's a state Senate district that is one large county, and then it takes a very small segment of another county, sort of plucks it out of the middle, and tosses it over a river. And you've talked about how important compactness is, and also Tom Ross about keeping counties together when possible. And I think this little pocket that was taken out of New Hanover County and tossed into Brunswick County is largely African American in a more urban setting than Brunswick County. Why does that matter to those constituents?
Well, I think, you know, people who live in similar places have different interests than people who live in different places. And so I don't know for certain because I don't live in Wilmington or in Brunswick County, but I know them because I come to them often. Wilmington is increasingly an urban community, and the issues they're facing, the problems they're facing are different than those in Brunswick County. And so in the ideal world of a democracy, you would have someone represent you that understands your issues because they live in the same community you do. So if you're taken out of the middle of Wilmington, which is an urban area, and placed in a in a different county that doesn't face the same issues, your representation may not be exactly what you want it to be.
Tom Ross, I need to jump in here. We just have a few seconds left. That's this edition of Coastline. Tom Ross, Jonathan Mattingly of Duke University, such a pleasure having you with us today. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. This show is engineered by Caleb Covington. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.